Good morning, everyone. Our event today is co-sponsored by two exceptional student organizations, STAND, or Students Taking Action Now in Darfur, and GARO, the Genocide Awareness and Research Organization, as well as UVA's Department of History. In particular, I'd like to thank Aydin Muratovic and Borna Kazrioni for their energy in bringing our speaker here today. Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. I'm Christina Lopez-Guitardi, Assistant Chair for the Forum Program. Our guest today is Gregory Stanton, who's the James Farmer Professor in Human Rights at the University of Mary Washington, and also the founder and president of Genocide Watch, the Cambodian Genocide Project, and the International Campaign to End Genocide. He was educated at Oberlin College, Harvard Divinity School, Yale Law School, and holds a doctorate in cultural anthropology from the University of Chicago. From 1992 through 1999, Mr. Stanton served in the State Department, where he drafted the UN Security Council resolutions that created the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, the Burundi Commission of Inquiry, and the Central African Arms Flow Commission. In 1994, he won the American Foreign Service Association's Avril Harriman Award for extraordinary contributions to the practice of diplomacy, exemplifying intellectual courage. Since leaving the State Department, he has been deeply involved in the UN-Cambodian government negotiations that brought about the creation of the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, and served as co-chair of the Washington Working Group for the International Criminal Court. Please join me in welcoming Gregory Stanton.
Thank you, Christina. It's a real honor to be here at the Miller Center, which is such a pioneering place for intellectual consideration of public policy issues. And I'm particularly pleased to be here as a Virginian because, as usual, Virginia is in the lead. I especially want to thank Governor Beliles for leading this center and for making it what it is. And I want to thank these student organizations, which are the hope, I believe, for ending genocide in the 21st century. It's the young people who are going to go on beyond us old people and make this campaign a success. Today, I want to talk to you about the eight stages of genocide. I first developed this model of the process of genocide when I was in the State Department in 1996. And the reason that I did it was because I realized that most of our diplomats didn't understand the process of genocide. In 2000, I left the State Department and became a leader of the non-governmental organizations that have been working to end genocide. But while I was there in the State Department, I was assigned in 1994 to deal with the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide. And what I realized after seeing our unfortunate response to that genocide was that most of our diplomats didn't know what genocide is, and also didn't know how to spot it when it was coming. By that time, I had been working on genocide as the head of the Cambodian Genocide Project since 1981, so I'd actually spent some time studying this subject and had taught about it. And I realized that, in fact, there was a real parallel between genocides in the way they developed. Let me first define genocide as it's defined in the International Convention. Genocide is the intentional destruction, in whole or in part, emphasize in part, of a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. One of the main mistakes that we made in Rwanda, I realized, was that our ambassador, and most ambassadors aren't trained as lawyers, so they don't know what you know, the legal definition is or something like that, thought that if there was a civil war going on, that there also could not be a genocide. In other words, that the two were mutually exclusive. When in fact, the research that we've done shows that genocide and civil war and international war usually go together, because war lowers the resistance to killing. I realized that for our diplomats, we also had gotten worried too much about the legal definition of genocide in the convention and not concerned enough about the early stages of the genocidal process that lead up to genocide. Before it's actually a, quote, genocide, we can see the early stages and can actually take action to prevent it. And so what I did was develop a model. What you have here in the room is my original paper, actually, the seventh stages of genocide, and I'll talk to you later about why I added an eighth, which is denial. But the key thing was, genocide is something you can see coming just the way we can see a hurricane coming, or an earthquake. There are forces, there are processes that we can identify. And so what I want to do is go through those stages with you and talk to you about them. Now, I don't mean this to be a linear model. It is not meant to be first it's this, then it's that, and so forth and so on. It's rather a logical model. It's a way to help us understand the process, because many of these things go on at the same time, many of these stages. But what it is a useful model to help us understand the process and then to know what we can do to prevent genocide at each of the stages, what steps we can take. The first stage is classification. We can't have genocide unless there are groups that are us groups and other groups that are them groups. It's natural for human beings to classify the world. Some people are Americans, other people are French. Some people are Hutus, some people are Tutsis, and so forth. The problem, of course, in classification is classifications can be used by leaders who want to increase their powers to divide the society, just as President Milosevic did in Yugoslavia, just as the Khmer Rouge did in Cambodia, in which they classified whole peoples as class enemies, just as the Nazis did during the Holocaust, by completely reclassifying German society, in fact, in the Nuremberg Laws, so that Jews were literally stripped of their German nationality. What can we do about this stage of classification to prevent genocide? We can develop universal institutions or transcendent institutions. We can emphasize those institutions that transcend the classifications. One, of course, is nationality. Right now, the Rwandan government is trying to emphasize that everybody's Rwandan, you know, not Hutu, not Tutsi, and so forth. That's not their first identity. In the United States, we do this in our celebration of being Americans. Another is common languages. In the United States, of course, English is one of those common languages. Fortunately, we don't have an official language. I think it's fortunate. But common languages are ways to overcome tribal divisions, if you will. In Tanzania, for instance, Swahili has been used in that way. There are also universal institutions that can combat classifications that are organized. What would have happened, for instance, during the Rwandan genocide, if the Catholic Church, instead of being divided just the way the rest of the society was divided, had instead been a voice against the classification system in Rwanda, had emphasized that everyone is first of all human. That's the basic classification if you really come down to it. One of the things that I like to say to people is, you know, the one mistake people make about race is to think there's more than one. We are really all members of the same race, the human race. In fact, I used to have fun with that when I was a Fulbright professor in Swaziland, and South Africa was still under apartheid, and I would cross the border, and every time I did, I'd have to fill out a form, and there was a place on the form where you had to write where it said race, and I just write human. Of course, the border guards would cross out, you know, that, and they'd write in Caucasian and so forth, and then I'd say, no, I'm not from the Caucasus. You know? But I think this emphasis on our common humanity is the key. The second stage, of course, is symbolization, because we have to put symbols on these classifications. We call some people Jews, we call some people Christians, we call some people Muslims. We have names that we put on them. Words are symbols. Sometimes the symbols are physical and are actually imposed. The most famous, of course, is the yellow star that the Nazis imposed on Jews. Ben Kiernan and I discovered when we were doing research on the Cambodian genocide that, in fact, when the Khmer Rouge decided to completely wipe out the eastern zone of Cambodia and to deport everyone from that zone, and get this, because, as they put it, they have Khmer bodies but Vietnamese minds. The eastern zone is right next to Vietnam. So what did they do? They decided to literally wipe them out. And to do it, they were going to send them all up the Mekong River and work them to death in work camps in other parts of the country. When we were out in a village one evening, I asked the question, when they were sending you up that river, did they give you new clothes? And they said, oh, yes. I said, what about the kroma, the scarf that, that every Cambodian wears in the rural areas? Oh, yes, we got new scarves. And I said, well, what color were they? And they said, blue. And a chill went down my spine, because I knew that the color of the anti-communist resistance in Cambodia was blue. And I said, did you have to wear them? Oh, yes, we had to wear them all the time. Did any other people wear the blue and white check scarves? Oh, no, only we. What did they mean? They were the killing sign. We'd essentially discovered the yellow star of Cambodia. Use of symbols, in other words, is crucial to carrying out a genocide. You have to be able to identify the group that you are targeting. There are many ways to do so. Dress, naming, sometimes uniforms, all kinds of other things. As you know, the Nazis developed a very, very elaborate system of symbols in the concentration camps. You know, pink triangles for homosexuals, purple triangles for Jehovah's Witnesses. Political prisoners had red triangles. I mean, and of course, all Jews had to wear the yellow, the Star of David. What do you do then about symbolization as a prevention? Well, one thing you can do is refuse to go along with it. In the case of Bulgaria, for instance, the government in Bulgaria and the church, the Orthodox Church of Bulgaria, told the Nazi authorities, no, we are not going to distribute those yellow stars. And so very few of them were distributed in Bulgaria. Result, almost all the Bulgarian Jews survived. The, of course, most famous legend is of Denmark, where the Nazis didn't even try to impose the yellow stars because, according to legend at least, they were told that the first person to wear one would be the king. Now, the fact is they never did impose them in Denmark because the Danish had started a major campaign of nonviolent resistance to the Nazis. The Nazis ordered them to produce ships, And during the entire war, the Danes never completed a single ship. So if you think nonviolent resistance is impossible, even against a totalitarian Nazi-type regime, think again. It actually can work even then. One of the ways that we do, of course, work as human beings is to always classify, always symbolize. Those things always happen in every culture. The real beginning of the downward spiral of genocide is dehumanization. It's when one group denies the humanity of another group. It's when people are called vermin, or cockroaches, or called diseases, or a cancer in the society. Very common language to prepare a society for genocide. And the reason for dehumanization, of course, is to allow those who are going to commit the genocide to feel that they are actually purifying the society. They are doing good. They're making for a better future. And as the great French philosopher Pascal said, there is nothing so evil as people who are doing the evil who believe they are doing good. The Nazis actually thought they were improving society in carrying out the Holocaust. The Soviet Union actually thought that by murdering class enemies, it was going to create a utopian society. So did the Maoist Chinese, and so did the Khmer Rouge. This dehumanization, in other words, dehumanizes the people who are targeted, makes them easy to kill. After all, they're not fully human. What do you do when you see this kind of dehumanization? First of all, you have to take strong action against the hate propaganda. Whenever you see it and those who are spewing it forth, you need to take action against them. You need to deny them visas to travel. You need to cut off their funding. You need to freeze the financing and so forth for these sorts of groups, because these are organized crime groups. You need to prosecute them for incitement, in fact, if their actions are directly intended to lead to action. The clear and present danger test that we use to distinguish between protected speech and incitement to crime is a good test, actually. You can, when you see this sort of propaganda going on, you can actually take direct action. You can jam the radios. The hate radio in Rwanda, for instance, should have been jammed. When I got back to the State Department for my first assignment in 1994, and asked people, why on earth didn't you jam the hate radio? They actually told me because it would have violated free speech. And I said, you know, I was a constitutional law professor over here at Washington and Lee for 7 years, and I can tell you that incitement to commit a crime is not protected speech in any system that I know of. And I also was told, and this is very, very sad, because it would have cost us $8,000 an hour to use our airplane to fly over Rwanda to jam that radio. Now figure out this on your own. 800,000 people were killed in 100 days in Rwanda. $8,000 per hour, 24 hours a day. Now calculate for yourselves how much we valued each human life. So those are some of the steps in combating the dehumanization. The next stage, the very crucial stage in genocide, is organization, because genocide is a group crime. It can't be carried out by a single person. It has to be the result of a plan or a policy. It's a crime of conspiracy. Now, in our system in the United States, we've developed some laws, in fact, that can deal with this sort of crime. As you know, we have enacted the RICO statutes to go after the mafia and after organized gangs. Similar laws can be, in fact, invoked against people planning a genocide. They should be treated as what they are, organized criminals. In fact, in the post-Holocaust period, simply being a member of the SS was considered enough to get you convicted. And when we see these groups forming, these hate groups, and see them training, see them getting ready to carry out a genocide, we have to take strong action. We've got to make sure they're outlawed, we've got to take strong action with the country that in which this is happening to impose arms embargoes by the United Nations and so forth, create commissions to investigate the violations. The fifth stage of genocide is polarization. It's when the extremists drive the groups apart. The hate groups broadcast polarizing propaganda, and in fact, they may even try to literally drive the groups apart by passing laws that forbid intermarriage or social interaction. That was done, of course, in the Nuremberg Laws in Nazi Germany. Interestingly enough, it is not just genocide in which we see these kinds of polarizing laws, as you know. The state of Virginia, I'm afraid, had an anti-miscegenation law until 19, would you believe, 67, in which it was literally illegal in this state for African Americans to marry white Virginians. And the most famous case on that, the best perhaps named case in constitutional history that finally struck that down, Supreme Court case, Loving versus Virginia, was about a couple, the Loving couple, yes, that was their name, who had gotten married in the District of Columbia and then had moved down to Caroline County, their home, tried to live together there, and literally the sheriff and his men walked into their bedroom and arrested them. Well, they sued, and they won. And all those anti-miscegenation laws across the United States were struck down in that wonderful, wonderfully named case. So when we see this sort of discrimination that tries to polarize a society, we have to take strong action against it. I am currently worried, I will say, and I will say this directly, about some of the attitudes towards, quote, illegal aliens that we are seeing cropping up in the United States today. Now, I'm not in favor of open borders and letting, you know, our country suddenly have 500 million people. But when we start talking about people as, quote, illegal aliens, let's ask ourselves what that sounds like. Do they come from Mars? I mean, really, think about it. Does our 14th Amendment really apply to all persons, because that's what it says, it doesn't say citizens, to all persons in the United States? Does it protect their rights to due process of law? I would just point out that discrimination is a step on the way to much greater crimes. The sixth stage, preparation, is when the victims are identified and separated because of their ethnic or religious identity. When we see this stage develop, we have to take action. A genocide alert needs to be declared. Death lists are drawn up. The members of the victim groups are forced to wear the identifying symbols. The segregation into ghettos is sometimes enforced, as it was in the Holocaust, or sometimes groups are literally forced into uninhabitable regions, the way, for instance, has happened in the Armenian genocide, or in the case of the way Southern Sudanese were treated by the Northern Sudanese during the long civil war that has come to an end in South Sudan, but right now is still underway in Darfur. What do you do when you have that kind of preparation? Well, you've got to mobilize. You've got to be ready for a genocide. If you can't get the United Nations to do anything about it, which is very difficult because of, unfortunately, the great power veto often paralyzing the UN, you can at least get regional organizations to take action. ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, was able to finally take action to bring to a halt the war in Liberia and Sierra Leone with the help of 400 British commandos, I will add. And 400 UN-authorized troops actually went to Macedonia to keep the conflict in Kosovo from spilling across the border into Macedonia. It's one of the most successful preventive actions that has been taken so far to prevent a genocide. And it kept the ethnic Albanian Muslim group in that country and the Macedonian group from having a civil war there in Macedonia, and they haven't yet. Another reason, of course, is that in Macedonia, both groups were led by fairly moderate leaders who were willing to sit down and negotiate a peace. All of these things, of course, are steps that are pretty far down the line. If we can take steps a lot earlier, it would be better. What, for example, if we could create institutions in a society to create what I would call an anti-genocidal culture? A culture that won't put up with intolerance, in which the church or the mosques or the temples educate their people about the fact that we're all human first, in which the basic religious institutions of the universe, of the society are harnessed to prevent rather than to cause genocide as religion is so often done. What happens if we can't stop it? At the very least, we have to be ready to have huge amounts of humanitarian assistance. And because there's going to be a huge tide of refugees. The seventh stage is extermination. It's the actual genocide itself. Now, you notice that all these previous stages aren't even mentioned in the Genocide Convention. We finally get to what's the definition, the intentional destruction of a group, in this seventh stage, extermination. Now, I have called it extermination here with reason, because the people who are actually committing the genocide think they're doing good. They actually think they're purifying their societies. They're wiping out cockroaches or vermin or a cancer or a disease. What do you do at this stage? Well, I'm convinced at this point you really do need rapid intervention. I mean rapid intervention. And right now we lack the international institutions to do that at the UN level. If the UN calls for a peacekeeping force, it takes months to organize. Remember that the Rwandan genocide was over in 3 months. So we need standing rapid response forces that can move in. The European Union has created one. NATO is another one. European Union is active in the Congo. As you know, NATO moved into Kosovo very quickly. We can create a similar kind of, I think, forces. The ECOWAS force in West Africa, led by Nigeria usually, is a possibility. The African Union actually has a very forward-leaning charter to allow creation of these forces. What I'm saying, though, is that at this stage, I think it's probably too late to simply practice diplomacy and hope it'll all go away. Diplomacy is very important. A peace agreement is very important. But we've also got to be willing to, when we make threats, back them up. We can't create, quote, safe areas, as we did in Srebrenica in Bosnia, that aren't safe. Those are worse than nothing because they give people a false sense of security. The final stage of genocide is denial. See that you have in your hands. I first thought there were just seven stages. You know, you got up to genocide and that was it. Well, what I realized after I watched what has happened in every genocide is that denial begins at the beginning. The people who are committing it try to hide it. They try to deny that they're doing it. And then they keep on denying it, and sometimes will keep on denying it for many, many, many years later. The Holocaust deniers made a complete industry of this for many, many years, in spite of the amazing amount of evidence of the Nuremberg trials. And as you know, there are other cases, many other cases of denial. I think the most probably difficult case right now is the continuing denial by the Turkish government of the Armenian genocide. We need Turkey. They're an ally. We have a major military base in Incirlik. And so we don't want to offend the Turks. And so the whole question is, how can we convince folks in Turkey? And this is happening, by the way. Turkish historians are coming to grips with what happened in the First World War. How can we convince people there that it's not some kind of terrible mark against them as people to talk about previous history, any more than it is a mark against Americans to finally admit, as we should, that we committed genocide in this country against Native Americans. Most Native Americans in the eastern United States are gone. And you know why? Because they were murdered. And we also committed genocide against a large number of African Americans. Slavery itself was a bad enough crime against humanity. But in the Middle Passage, bringing the African Americans from Africa, millions of Africans died. And that, folks, because the captains knew what the consequences of that Middle Passage would be, that the mortality rate would be so high, was genocide. We need to come to grips with our own history and admit it. Denial, in other words, needs to be addressed by confession and, if possible, by some way of reparation in which groups that have been the victims of genocide can be somehow restored. I also believe, and this is, as you know, a very strong theme of my life, tomorrow, the Cambodian Tribunal is opening its very first trial. It is the dream of my life come true. I founded the Cambodian Project in 1981. And when I first founded it, I was a student at Yale Law School. I had come back from Cambodia as the field director of a relief program. And I had seen what had happened there. And I said, these people have gotten away with mass murder. They should be put on trial. And I went around to all the human rights groups, and none of them would touch it. And so my professor said, well, why don't you do it? And I said, because I'm just a student. And they said, ah, but you are a Yale law student. Now, that was terribly elitist. But I would say the same thing to you. I would say to the students here at the University of Virginia and to the people here, don't wait until you're finished with school. You can start now. You are a University of Virginia student. That's pretty good, I think. And I know after now working since 1981 and working relentlessly to get this tribunal that it has in fact now come about. I wrote the rules for it. And they're just about to start the trial tomorrow. That type of justice, where the facts are finally brought out, and where history will finally be able to just judge those who committed the crimes, is the best answer for denial. It is the best answer, at least against the top leaders in the country who have planned the genocide. It is not a complete answer, because it is not enough to restore an entire society. There have to be other means of dealing with a terrible crime as big as genocide. Just as, for instance, in Rwanda, they've developed the Gacaca courts, which are village-level courts to deal with all of the perpetrators. Some people estimate as many as 200,000 people actually participated in the killing of the 800,000 people in Rwanda. How do you deal with that many people? Well, they've adapted African systems of justice there to try to come to terms and bring about some reconciliation in that country. We now finally have an International Criminal Court. I believe it's very important. I think we should eventually become part of it. I think our fears of it are unjustified. And I think right now, for instance, it is a major step forward that the President of Sudan has been indicted by the International Criminal Court. And he will, I think, as Luis Moreno Ocampo, the chief prosecutor, says, he may think he will get away with this, but as Luis says, he will end up in the dock. The Khmer Rouge have ended up in the dock. I do believe in what Martin Luther King said, that the moral arm of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice. What we are really embarked upon here is an effort to bring justice to human relations, to re-emphasize our common humanity, and to end genocide in the 21st century. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Stanton. In a few moments, I'll head to the back of the room to take questions from the audience. So I invite everyone to please line up in the back and ask your question. But let me begin the conversation by asking, the UN Office of Humanitarian Assistance and the CIA both use different statistical models to help predict the likelihood of genocide and other forms of political violence. They assign scores to different kinds of risk factors, such as levels of democracy and ethnicity and different things of that sort. How useful are these models, and what kind of a critique do you have of them?
I think they're actually very useful. Some of the models, as you know, are what I would call risk models, in which the factors are essentially probabilities of risks in certain societies. One of the best models that I know of was developed by Barbara Harf and Ted Gurr, and they discovered that there were six major factors that were big risk factors that would predict future genocides. A history of past genocide in the country with impunity, an authoritarian government, exclusionary ideology in the ruling elite. Get this, interestingly enough, trade openness. Genocidal regimes try to shut off their borders so that nobody can see what they're doing. In other words, those models, I think, are very useful for predicting risk. What I've done with the eight-stage model is to try to show how those risk factors then develop as a process. So I'm convinced that we need to put together these models so that we can then take action as we see genocide developing. I do think that they're quite useful, and I think we're one of the great advantages, of course, of public policy schools is they provide the places where people can, in fact, study these terrible questions and can, in fact, develop the models and the understandings we need.
I would like to ask you about the possibility of overt versus covert rationales for genocide. Religion, ethnicity being the overt manifestations, but economics being the covert, the wish to get somebody else's property or business. In the Sudan, the disappearing of the water, the aquifers are going and they don't have enough water now. So they're trying to get rid of the people so they will have more water. And would you comment about this?
Yes, I think that's a very cogent observation. Genocide has many parents, if you will, many reasons why groups are in conflict with each other. Economics is clearly an important one. I think it's no accident that the Rwandan genocide occurred right after the coffee market completely fell apart. It was one of their main crops. It was also a very overpopulated country. But some of those things are not quite enough to really account for genocide, because the truth is that even though Rwanda was overpopulated, it hadn't had genocide before that, of that scale at least, and overpopulation itself doesn't cause genocide. You can look at Singapore or the Netherlands or some other countries that are even more populated. You can look at economics. You can look at countries that are poorer or that are even worse shape, where there's even less water, and they haven't had genocides either. I'm convinced, in other words, that genocide is at base a politically driven force. In other words, it takes leaders to organize a genocide. It takes people who are determined to have a genocide in their country to increase their own power. And in fact, one of the best studies of that, Ben Valentino's book, Final Solutions, tests out these different explanations for genocide statistically, and he finds that the most convincing explanation is an authoritarian leadership group that is bent on increasing or holding on to its own power. And so I think that all of these reasons, as you say, some overt, some covert, need to always be taken into consideration. But we also should never forget that we have to deal with the leaders that organize a genocide.
This may be considered irrelevant. How would you classify what we did to the Nisei, Sansei, separating them, putting them in camps that were unpleasant after Pearl Harbor, and looking down on them?
It was not genocide because, of course, the objective was not to destroy the groups. That means, in other words, we need to look carefully at the definition, intent to destroy a group. It was very clearly terrible discrimination, unjustified, I think, discrimination. And it, as you know, we finally apologized for it. The Congress finally did. And there's been reparations for it. But I think that what you've pointed out is basically that discrimination is a step along the way. You know, it could have gotten much worse. And what would have happened, for instance, if the Japanese had invaded Alaska? How would those people in those camps have been treated then? So I think you're right to point out the scale, the sliding, slippery slope that can lead into genocide. It's exactly what we need to be aware of. It's one of the reasons I'm so worried about Iraq right now. I think if we are not careful there, that society could, in fact, slip into genocidal violence. And it's there are many places in the world, of course, like that. Yes.
Thank you. I found the presentation extremely provocative. One observation and one question, if I may. Some of the groups that practice the very points you make in your outline are, in fact, victims of prior genocidal activities.
That's right.
And I know my own Jewish community takes great pains to keep its language alive, for example, and encourages the adoption of languages which separate it from the greater community. That's an observation, sir. What I was more curious about was there was a recent article in the Washington Post, I think the editorial section, pointing out the activities of Cesar Chavez in Venezuela, engaging in many of the same kinds of activities that Hitler did prior to Kristallnacht. And I'm wondering whether your advocacy for direct action would be triggered, assuming that the Washington Post was accurate, And what form that action should take? Are we talking embargoes? Are we talking invasions? How are we going to respond to this? And do we even have jurisdiction in this country to move against those kinds of activities beyond our borders? Thank you.
Although I believe that President Chavez in Venezuela is a dangerous man, has very strong authoritarian tendencies. You may know that after the desecration of the synagogue there, he denounced it. I don't think he supports the activities of the anti-Semitic forces in Venezuela. I don't think it would be wise for us at this point, at least, to threaten any kind of military or other action based on those desecrations in Venezuela. However, I would strongly recommend some policies in Sudan that I know have not often been discussed. Sudan basically depends on oil for all of its income, and it also mostly ships it to China. And it also depends on gasoline coming in because it doesn't have any refineries. What would happen if Sudan was suddenly offered the option of either you stop this killing against the people in Darfur, or we are going to send our naval vessels around the port of Sudan, Port Sudan, and we're just going to blockade you. We've done it before, to keep nuclear missiles out of Cuba. And we don't intend to kill anybody. We don't intend to kill a single person. But we just are going to cut off your flow of money. I think they would come to the negotiating table a lot more quickly. I also think, for instance, that if we told them, if you keep using your Antonov aircraft to bomb villages in Darfur, and they're still doing it, by the way, we're going to get our friends the French and perhaps some other allies to use their air base in Abache with their Mirage fighters, and we're just going to wait until your planes land, and there are no people in them, and we're going to come over some night and just destroy your air force after they've done the bombing. In other words, with the aim of not carrying out any killing of any people at all, but rather to say, look, we don't agree with your doing this genocide, and so we're going to try to take the potential or the capability away from you.
I'm very much interested in what you have to say about illegal immigration. I think there's no denying that it clearly fits your description of developing into a genocide, especially with the polarization. I mean, we were considering building a border wall, and then San Francisco opened itself and advertised that it could be a haven for illegal immigrants. But in this case, I think there's a major difference in that there's an actual legal issue. And so how would you, with their presence in our country, so how would you balance our consideration of the illegality of their presence and the unfortunate attitudes we take towards all immigrants?
I don't predict, actually, that the attitudes that we have towards so-called illegal aliens, I underline the word aliens, in the United States is going to result in genocide in the United States, by the way. Let me make that very clear. I think at this point, at least, it is reached the point of polarization and discrimination. But I do think that because we have a democracy and because we have legislative ways of dealing with these issues, that's the way to deal with it. As you may know, laws that were proposed, bipartisan laws, in fact, Senator McCain was one of the sponsors of these laws, and Senator Kennedy, to deal with the illegal immigration problem in the United States, have been proposed, and I hope such laws will be passed so that we can regularize the status of a lot of people who are already here, and we can provide for avenues for legal entry into the United States for those people who do need to come or who we need in the United States. In other words, I'm not an advocate of, you know, lawlessness or anything of the sort. But I do think that we just have to see that some of the forces that can eventually lead to worse things are also present. And that was why I pointed that out. Yes.
Thank you very much. And I wanted to question what you said about authors of genocide desiring good, because I think that's a very important question. And if you have a political group exploiting the hatreds that exist between communities, I don't see good anywhere. Because on one side you have the desire for power, and on the other side you have the blindest, most primitive instincts that are encouraged by people, but in no way for any kind of good. And and I wanted to quote our president, because in Dreams of My Father, he says that when he was in Indonesia as a young boy, his Indonesian father-in-law started instructing him in the logics of power. And his mother saw that and took him by the scruff of the neck and sent him to Hawaii. And that is why we have this president.
Thank you very much. Now, I do agree with you. There are some people who engage in genocide who are fully aware of the evil they're doing. No question at all, you're right. But in order to sell it to the biggest number of people in the population, in order to get ordinary people to participate in it, and that is what you need to do. You need to get ordinary people to participate in it. You have to celebrate, you have to somehow sell it to those ordinary people as good, good for the society. That was the point that I was making.
I was wondering if you could spell out the objections that the United States has for participating in the ICC.
Sure. The International Criminal Court was objected to by the US because it was seen as a threat to our sovereignty. The real threat being especially to American military personnel that they thought might be hauled before the court for war crimes and crimes against humanity in other countries. The answer, complete answer, I believe, to that objection is that the ICC only has complementary jurisdiction. In other words, the first crack at anybody who is accused of being a war criminal, including our own military, is that the ICC is literally required by its treaty, by the Rome Treaty, to refer that case to to inform the United States that it is about to investigate such and such a case. And the military courts of the United States have complete jurisdiction from then on, unless they simply say, we refuse to accept jurisdiction. In other words, there is, I think, almost no chance that any of our military would ever be tried in the ICC, and the reason is that we have a very good military justice system. It's not perfect by any means, but our military would be tried in our own courts. And I think that is the key thing. The other thing, key thing is to remember that the ICC's jurisdiction is only over three kinds of crimes: genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. And so the average run-of-the-mill American citizen has absolutely nothing to fear from the ICC. I'm convinced, in fact, it is a major step forward for international justice. Yes.
So I apologize if this is an overly broad question, but what steps do you think can, like, realistically be made to have changes in the United Nations to enable it to respond quicker to crimes against humanity, such as genocide?
That is a very big question. As you know, the UN was founded with the political realities of the time in 1945, in which certain countries insisted on having a veto in the UN Security Council, or else they would not join, particularly the United States and the Soviet Union, by the way. In order to alter the charter, you basically got to get the five permanent members of the Security Council to go along with the alteration. And so I'm not very optimistic at this point of altering the charter to change that aspect, in other words, the veto. But what I do think is that the United Nations has other ways that it could invent to take action. One of them, for instance, is one that, in fact, I suggested way back in 1999, and that is that the PERM 5 members of the UN Security Council make an agreement among themselves that if a majority, that is 9 out of the 15 members of the Security Council, vote that a genocide is underway somewhere, that those 5 members agree among themselves in advance they will not cast a veto. Now, that actually has been taken up in a report on the responsibility to protect. I don't know whether there's a realistic possibility there right now, but it is a way to perhaps at least mitigate that weakness. There is also the Uniting for Peace resolution, of course, in the General Assembly. The General Assembly actually has power to take action. We don't like it very much because we don't have a veto, but that is another way. And as I say, regional organizations are also authorized under the UN Charter to take action. They're supposed to then submit their actions to approval by the United Nations, but I think the key thing with genocide is to act fast. And so actually having regional organizations take action is one of the best, I think, solutions.
Well, thank you very much for that excellent presentation. I'm very interested in what you're sharing because I'm very troubled by the tribal clashes that are happening in Kenya. They always seem to happen when there's elections happening, so they are very connected to political power. And I wanted to find out what if you think that those could be seeds of a genocide present in Kenya. And secondly, I would also want to know how would education play an active role in the prevention of genocide? Because I think that many African countries are very, very vulnerable
to genocide. I think those are both very, very good questions. We, by the way, Genocide Watch, was very, very active in the when Kenya began its slide into genocide after the elections. We helped mobilize some of our partners, the Realizing the Dream Foundation of Martin Luther King III, for instance. He went to Kenya. We helped organize a conference of business people in Kenya. You probably know about that. The business people basically said, no, we are not going to have a genocide here. And they were listened to. The churches also were organized in Kenya to stop it. I think the way that Kofi Annan intervened and with his incredible diplomatic skill actually did help bring about a settlement there was also something for which he should get a second Nobel Prize. But I agree with you that these forces are present in many, many societies, and I think that education is the key. I'd like to see every high school student in every country have a unit of study on genocide. I'd like to see it here in Virginia. In fact, there is a bill in front of the Virginia legislature right now to put a book in the hand of every high school teacher about genocide. They're not yet mandating it as part of the curriculum because of our budget cuts. But in a number of states, it is a mandated part of the curriculum. In California, in New Jersey, in Massachusetts, I'd like to see that. And I think it should be a worldwide part of the curriculum. I'd also like to see mobilization of the churches. Can you imagine if we made anti-genocide one of the key teachings in every Sunday school and synagogue and mosque around the world? I mean, can you imagine the force? Let me give you an example of this. And this is a true story. It was just reported the 31st of January in the New York Times in a story about this. A group of Lutheran church ladies in Liberia had had enough of the mass murders in Liberia under Charles Taylor and by the rebel groups that were opposed to him. And they decided, I'm I'm not kidding. She had a dream in which she was told she should gather her people together and they should pray every day for peace in Liberia. And not only pray, but they went out into the market and they had demonstrations and it grew. And then they brought in the Muslim population as well. At first they thought, geez, that might, you know, somehow, you know, be a problem for us theologically. Of course it wasn't. And so the Muslim ladies, these are women, and Christian ladies of Liberia banded together. They would have these demonstrations daily in the fish market of Monrovia, and nothing could stop them. The rain, the heat, the anger of Charles Taylor. They eventually got both sides in that conflict to agree to listen to them. Diplomats, of course, were also putting pressure on. Talks got started in Accra to bring that conflict to a halt. And when the talks were about to break down, I am not kidding, this is a true story, this woman took 200 of her people to Accra, and they sat in at the place where the talks were going on and demanded that they come to resolution and end this war. Now, if you think nonviolent resistance is not powerful, that is a great example of its power. And as you know, it did result in an end to the war. Charles Taylor was exiled to Calabar, Nigeria. 3 years later, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the first woman president of an African country, was elected in Liberia. And today, Charles Taylor is in The Hague and in the dock.
Destruction, dehumanization, polarization, denial. In 1948, I, along with my family, were forced from our home and never allowed to return. Today, Israel, the Israeli government, sorry, because many of the Israeli people, especially the women in black and others who are demonstrating against the Israeli government's policy, I have not heard one word that you said that mentioned the word Israel and the Israeli government in their treatment of the Palestinians in Palestine and in the Gaza Strip. Comment, please.
Oh, I knew this one would come. I'm happy to comment. There's been a raging debate, as you can well imagine, in the organization that I am president of, the International Association of Genocide Scholars, about this very issue right now. The question that some people have asked is this genocide? I would ask even bigger question. Even if it is not, quote, genocide, you know, in the full-scale sense, have there been genocidal massacres? Because I'd like to, I think the all or none definition of genocide is one of our problems. We don't actually use the word genocide enough, I think. But I'd like to qualify that by pointing out that genocidal massacres may not be a full-scale genocide, but if they're especially targeted against a particular group, an ethnic group, or racial group, or religious group, national group, they may be genocidal in their implications. Now, let me point out another thing here that's going on in Israel and in Palestine, in Gaza, and other areas around in the Middle East. I don't think that the intention of the Israeli government, you know, is to commit genocide against Palestine. And I also don't think that many of the people who are in Israel, who are not Jewish, I don't believe they have genocidal intent either. However, I do think if you read the charter of Hamas, you have to be very concerned. They do talk about the destruction of the state of Israel. Now, there are many ways to read that, as you know. And some people have said that when President Ahmadinejad of Iran has called for Israel to be wiped off the map, all he's talking about is really sort of a political dissolution, you know, of the state of Israel. I have a problem with that, because when they paint it on the side of ballistic missiles and they're developing nuclear weapons, it makes me very concerned that they really maybe mean it in the most literal way. Nobody believed that Adolf Hitler would do what he did to the Jews when he wrote Mein Kampf. They thought it was too incredible. And we now know that he did. So I think we have to really be on guard, in the Middle East especially, for these genocidal forces on all sides. One of my dear friends, Yehuda Bauer, who was the head of the Yad Vashem Memorial in Jerusalem, has estimated that there are at least a quarter of the population on either side, on the Palestinian side or on the Israeli side, on both sides, that actually do have genocidal ideologies, who would like to see the other side wiped out. That's really, really worrisome to me. And their most recent election, of course, showed just how strong sentiment is in Israel not to negotiate and to allow for an independent Palestinian state. In other words, I'm not a specialist in the Middle East and would hate to try to prescribe, you know, a solution of some kind that I think will be far more complex than I could ever do. But I am very concerned, as a specialist on the crime of genocide and on genocidal massacres, with genocidal forces that I think are present in the Middle East today.
Professor Stanton, we thank you for sharing your vast knowledge on this subject with us. Thank you.